Well, let's start with a question that came in here on Twitter. Thank you both very much for what you've shared. Just fantastic, really, really helpful. Mary Jo, would you mind taking this one? The question that came in is has to do with, I don't know if you've read this book, doesn't really matter, but Greg Epstein has written an extremely popular book called Good Without God. This book tries to dismiss the claim that moral absolutes have to be connected to God. Can you explain why moral absolutes can only exist if God does?
That's a good question. So, Good Without God. Are you familiar with the book?
Because
I
little,
haven't read it.
Yeah.
Do you want to start? And I'll...
Well, I can do.
Okay.
Two Christians on a stage, right? After you. No, after you. No, after you.
Well, if you've read the book, you know.
Well, I've skimmed the book. But,
okay.
But yeah, because Matt asked about this earlier. Yeah, let me talk about this a little bit. Actually, Mary Jo reminded me that she ended her talk with a shameless plug for all of her books, and then I was very British and didn't mention mine. So I actually answered this question in The Atheist Who Didn't Exist. So if you haven't got a copy of the brightest, reddest apologetics book you will ever read, there are copies available on the book table afterwards. And I've also been told to tell you that Mary Jo and I will be signing copies of our books out there afterwards. You almost bought all of her books last night. There's about two or three that you haven't, so do go buy those so she can go home empty. But she'll be signing, and I'll be signing, and I answer this question in there. But for those of you who can't afford $15 and would rather spend that on a latte in Starbucks, let me give you the quick answer to this question. I mean, what's interesting with Greg's book, and there are other books like it from atheists and humanists who've tried to argue that we can be good without God, I want to credit them with recognizing they have a problem. Because I think the issue of goodness and morality is one of the biggest challenges for an atheist. Because if you are an atheist and a consistent atheist, you really are wedded to the idea that the universe is just atoms and particles in motion. And the problem with that is, of course, how you then get morality and goodness out. Because if Matt over here is nothing more than a very attractive collection of atoms, thank you, you can pay me $5 later, then if I come along here and remove his head, all I've done is rearrange atoms, and it's no different to moving a table across the platform. And obviously, his family might complain, but we've just rearranged atoms. So I think many atheists, realizing there's a problem here, have tried to argue, well, there are ways we can get goodness without God. And there's a number of ways you can try and do it. You can try and argue that, well, society determines what is good. That tends to not be so favored these days because, of course, we have plenty of examples of societies that have produced all kinds of morally abhorrent behavior. I think of Nazi Germany, for example. The most common way that atheists try and argue we can be good without God is to appeal to evolutionary models of ethics. And it goes like this. You would say as an atheist, well, what happens is that, not killing one another means that we build stronger societies, it's a better place to raise our children, and therefore evolution has selected for moral behavior, and that's how we can be good without God. We don't need God to explain goodness. Now, on the one hand, that can sound quite compelling, and that's probably true to an extent. I would rather live in a society where people didn't clobber each other over the head and run off with their possessions. I can see how that makes for a much more conducive environment for raising children. Although anyone who's raised young children, there's often a lot of clobbering that goes on. I often separate my two. My 16-month-old has discovered the joys of waving a plastic hammer around and whacking his 3-year-old sister. But there's a problem with evolutionary ethics. Well, several problems. If ethics evolves, of course, that raises the problem one, we can't criticize the past. What do I mean? Well, think back to 200 or 300 years ago. Think back to the height of the slave trade. Potentially, slavery was the very best that our ancestors could engage in. They hadn't evolved a higher form of morality by then. And so I can't criticize them. In fact, my criticizing our ancestors for practicing slavery would be like my criticizing my pet cat for being unable to use a tin opener and open the cat food container on its own because it hasn't evolved thumbs yet. But yet, many of my atheist friends want to criticize the past. I want to criticize the past. But if ethics purely evolves, we can't do that. Furthermore, of course, if ethics evolves, that still doesn't say why I have to behave that way. It merely tells me that it's useful. And there will be all kinds of situations where we might find behaviors useful that might be morally abhorrent. In fact, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, is on record as saying he could conceive of a society in which rape would be okay. It's a pretty dramatic thing to say. I want to say as a Christian that there is actually a real, genuine moral realm out there that things are good and evil, not because of what society thinks, not because of how far our thinking has progressed, not because something is useful, but because it really is right or it really is wrong. But if we only live in a universe that consists of nothing more than atoms and particles jostling together, it's very hard to see how we can get there. And so to Greg and to other atheists and humanists, I want to say to them, I'm really glad that you've worked out that morality is important and something we want to talk about. But I want to encourage you to come home to the source of all goodness and also to the only one who can deal with the issue of evil in our own hearts. Because quite frankly, the biggest problem in the world is not how we explain goodness out there, but what we do about evil in here. And the gospel answers both those questions.
Yeah. I'm just going to real quick on that. Well, I'll stand up. I'll take some time. Sometimes when this question is asked of us, they're asking the actual philosophical question, and you have to establish a standard of goodness, which is what Andy was going through. You have to have that standard, that plumb line, in order to know what good is, or you have a changing definition of good. You have a movable target. And like he said, then how would you say something was wrong, like the horrendous acts in Nazi Germany? But the other part of this question that I hear is sometimes what I'm hearing is offense, because people who are not believers in God will say that, are you saying that I can't do good because I don't believe in your God? And that's, I want to make sure that we clarify, so like if you're not a believer here tonight, that's not what we're saying. Because we believe in a standard of goodness, because we believe that it is God, we believe not only that it exists, that there is real good and evil, but we believe that you can do good because you're human, not necessarily because you're it's not tied specifically to a believer being a believer in God. That's not what we're saying. So I want to make sure and clarify that. We believe that people who are not Christian can do good, but we believe that when you tie it back, when you try to tie it definitionally backwards, you have to find a place to land. You have to find that source for the definition of what you're saying is good and not good or evil. Thank you.
All right, let's go over here.
Got a question regarding witnessing to people, non-Christians, and I've found when a few times I've had a discussion, it comes down to the fact that my non-Christian friends want to do what they want to do, how they want to do it. They're not opposed to God, but they're just like, I want to be my own authority. How do you reach that person?
Great, thank you.
All right.
You want to go first?
Yeah, so you're dealing with people who want to be their own authority, right? And so, you know, when you're trying to witness to them, they're saying, like, you're trying to give me this standard, but here's what I want to do. Okay, that's great. If it reminds me of James Madison's statement, if men were angels, we'd need no government, right? So if the problem is, if we were all good people, good, you know, whatever that would mean, we'd have to define that. But if we were all good people, then we could all do whatever we want to do, and it would be all right, because we would do what was good. And that's, I mean, that's the whole idea of the Christian new heavens and new earth, is that we all live together and we are autonomous, we have personhood, and we do what's right. So the problem comes when you find those people who want to do what they want to do, like a sociopath, and we would have no say into that, right? They are just doing what they want to do. So if a sociopath wants to murder and rape and kill, then who am I to judge that, right? So this problem of autonomy is that what is the... So how do we say that it goes back to our problem here of goodness? How do we curtail some of these things that we want to do, which would hurt other people, or it would not just hurt them, but it would also take away their autonomy? Like if I murder someone, now they can't be autonomous anymore because they have ceased to be living, right? So the problem comes when you say, hey, I just want to do whatever I want to do, leave me alone. Well, when we look out into the world, that doesn't seem to be the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is that people are going to do things that take away the autonomy of other people. We have several examples of whole cultures that did this, of whole societies like Nazi Germany, like Joseph Stalin starving the Ukraine. So the problem with saying that is that we as humans, we aren't respecting one another. We don't do that. It doesn't come naturally. This almost assumes like a natural state of peace for mankind, that that's what we would resort to. But we know from our own history, that's not what we're going to resort to. So what do we do? This goes back to the problem of mankind. What is our problem? Why can't we just live in peace? It's because in our autonomy, with our free will, we choose to do the things that are not good. And we choose to do things that have destroyed creation, destroyed relationship, destroyed the goodness that we were intended for. So this is the kind of language I want to talk, I want to use with a person who just wants their autonomy. Is that might be fine if we were all angels, but it's not going to work for the reality of the situation because there's a problem with mankind. So what's the solution to that? Right? That's what I would want to talk about.
Yeah. Let me just add one thing. Quickly to that, I think what I'd actually say is, for as hard as that can sometimes be when you run into that, I actually appreciate when you can get to that point in a dialogue with somebody, because now you're reaching honesty. Because to go, it's very easy to hide behind questions and objections. And one of the things I've sometimes learned to do in dialogues with atheist friends is somebody raises a question like, you know, I can't believe in Christianity because the Bible is a load of rubbish. It's quite sometimes interesting to say, tell me, if I were to answer that question to your satisfaction, would you become a Christian? If they say yes, go, okay, I'll hold you to that. Now let's talk. If they say no, then you can say, okay, what's the question that I would need to answer in order for you to become a Christian? Because I'm not interested in playing around, mucking around and playing word games. I want to get to the real issue. And sometimes by pulling away the baggage, you can get to the underlying issue, such as, well, I just want my own autonomy. And as Mary Jo, you know, gave you some thoughts there on how to then respond to that, at least now you're dealing with the honesty of the human heart. And even then, I'd be tempted to look at the person and say, let me get this straight. Are you saying that you believe that Christianity is true, that Jesus is who he claimed to be, but I don't want any of that because I want my own autonomy? Because to me, that's utterly foolish. But at least we're now dealing with the honesty of the naked rebellion that's going on there and not hiding it under, you know, intellectual pretension, such as, well, I can't believe because of this problem. So I think I'd encourage people, when you talk to your friends, try and dig below until you get to bedrock. And in the situation you've described, I think you're pretty close to bedrock. It's going to be tough, but at least you're now dealing honestly rather than playing games.
All right, let's go over here. Maybe Andy, start with this one.
Hi, thanks so much, both of you. So on the topic of truth as it intersects with race in the church, how can Christians claim to be logical and consistent and compassionate and at the same time have such a tough time with race? I mean, something as simple as having a white portrayal of Jesus when that's, you know, not obviously what a Middle Eastern dude was, right? I mean, how can we claim to be logical and consistent in the church with such a conflict there?
Good question. How can we claim to be logical and consistent when we have an issue with kind of race in the church? Is that a kind of good summary? Yeah, okay. I think you raise a hugely important point. I mean, I think we have to be very, very honest here as Christians and say we've got a lot of work to do in many, not all, of our churches. I mean, certainly in the UK where I grew up, and I think I noticed it not quite so much here in Canada, but I still think we have an issue. There's very noticeably churches that were white churches that were black churches, and never the twain shall meet. And trying to get, you know, a lot more cooperation between the two can be tough. And I think that's a travesty of the gospel, because the whole point of the gospel, you know, as Paul points out in Galatians, you know, in Christ there is no Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. It's supposed to bring us together. And I think one of the interesting things, I think, is when we do that well, and there are times the church has done it well, it's a tremendous witness to the world. Because what I would say is, I would say to skeptics and doubters, I would say what's interesting is I think the gospel offers the only solution when it's lived out to racial tension that I know. I think many of the other world's religions are highly stratified. Think of the caste system in Eastern religions. Islam has a huge issue with race. In colloquial Arabic, the word for a black person is the word abd, which is the word for slave. And hugely controversial if you raise that with Arab audiences, but that's sadly the truth. Christianity, on the other hand, has not just Galatians, has that tremendous vision in the Book of Revelation of people of every tribe and every tongue worshipping God. God loves race, God loves culture because he invented it. And I think we have to do a better job as Christians of living out what that means. So I think the challenges are on those of us who live and worship in churches, in multicultural settings like here in Vancouver, to think very, very hard about what that means. To listen to one another on both sides, I think those of us like myself who are white need to listen to those of other ethnicities, but that goes in both directions. We need to do a lot more listening and a lot less shouting. And also not be afraid to recognize where we've made mistakes. But I think what I would say, underpinning it all, is to say this, is to come back to the idea that the gospel, I think, offers the only true recognition of human dignity, no matter what someone's race or gender or background. But we need to do a better job of living that out. And in a world that I think is crying out for answers in this area, if you look at some of the issues that we're facing here in North America, I think it's an incredibly important time for the church to speak out. And there are some also, I'd finally say, there are some wonderful Christian leaders doing tremendous work in this area. One writer I can recommend, there's a gentleman called Chris Brooks, who's a pastor in Detroit, very good friend of Mary Jo and mine, who's an African-American pastor, wrote a wonderful book called Urban Apologetics, and has got a great section in there on race. And he is doing incredible work in that very difficult urban context in terms of building connections and doing reconciliation and peace work, bringing communities together, and seeing huge fruit for the gospel when that's done well. So thank you for the question.
All right, let's go over here. We have one.
I'll just summarize them. They're both very closely the same question, but how do you begin to overcome the fear of sharing the hope that you have, and what are maybe some ways you would recommend to somebody just starting to do this, maybe some practical steps?
Okay. That's a very good question. I want to acknowledge, because, you know, I've spoken tonight on sharing this, sharing your faith. And probably, you know, where I'm at, I'm on the stage, it seems like, oh yeah, she's got it worked out, right? She's got it figured out. But I came from Portland, Oregon, in which it was a culture in which you felt that it wasn't appropriate to share your faith, right? Okay, so you're like, yes, I get this. So it felt like I had this idea, and I wasn't sure where it came from, that if I were to talk to people about these things, it would be like pushing my religion on them or shoving it down their throat. And so what I hope we've shown you tonight is it doesn't have to be like that. It can be more of a dialogue. So I want to first, before I give you the practical things, I want to make sure you understand that this comes from, and I mentioned this last night, One of the ways that we can get beyond the fear is by making sure we're taking care of ourselves and God. Okay, that's first, right? Because Ken Sandy, who he wrote the book, The Peacemaker, he said, we cannot consistently weave the gospel into our conversation with others until the gospel's deeply woven in us. And I just don't want to skip that part. I think part of our conversations, one of the major aspects is, what are we doing spiritually with our own lives? Because it's, as Jesus says, it's, you know, from the overflow of the heart. It's what you're putting in that comes back out. And so many Christians are trying to have conversations about belief in God without putting stuff in, right? Without building themselves up, without letting God minister to them. God being the ultimate minister to show you the way. Let him minister to you, and then you can give something back out. Now the fear factor, one of the best ways, couple of things. As I said in my talk, one of the best things to do is just start talking to people. Yeah, find a person that you disagree with and say, hey, I want to know, you know, I'm a Christian. I want to know what you believe, right? And listen to them. Don't make it confrontational. Don't make it about, hey, I'm going to question this and I'm going to find, you know, we've given you some good stuff tonight, but if you want to start, if you have that, I'm not sure what to do, I'm not sure how I would respond, we'll ask somebody a question, and then with the intention of, I'm going to listen to them the first time around, or maybe I'm going to offer just, you know, one question here or there. If you're still like, that is an introvert nightmare. I'm not only introverted, I'm shy, Mary Jo. Okay, well then, what I made some suggestions in Why Do You Believe That? For those people who are just extremely shy, practice with whatever you've got available. Is it the news? Practice asking questions first with people on the news or things you're seeing on television, or watch some atheists give a full lecture online, and then just start thinking, what would I say in that situation? How would I respond to that? And start asking him or her, looking at the screen. So there's like a very non-intimidating first way to get into it, and then think, how would you, what would you ask, and then where would you go with the conversation? Then also, for people who are very shy, do you have an extrovert friend? Let them lead the conversation. Bring them along. My husband's extroverted. If you spend much time with us, you'll find that he does most of the initial engaging, and then I come alongside when we're in a big group of people or when we're talking to people we don't know. So I'll let the extrovert sort of lead the way, and then I'll come in with some of my questions. So those of you who are really shy, and that's not your type of thing, if you've got that friend that's not, let them be the initiator, okay? But the most important thing is that you need to really try, and you need to trust in God's authority enough to be willing to fail miserably in a conversation, right? So either he has been given all authority, Jesus has either been given all authority, like he says in Matthew 28, or he hasn't. And if he's been given all the authority over all things, then we need to give him the authority for the conversation, okay? Step out in faith in his authority and say, I'm just going to hand this over to you, and I'm going to start trying. And I know I'm going to fail. Yes. He's saying what he has the responsibility for is to be faithful to God, right? And let him take care of the situation. And what's amazing is you'll get into some of the best conversations you've ever had in your life. I've never been disappointed by learning from people, their beliefs, who totally disagree with me. It's been some of the best conversations I've ever had. Those are my points for you.
All right, so let's wrap it up for this portion this way. And then just so you know, if you have more questions for Andy or Mary Jo, they're going to be out these doors near the resource table. They're going to be there to take questions, sign books, all that kind of stuff. So you can meet them and talk to them more there. But Andy, why don't you take this one? So we have a question from Twitter. The person is asking, now, why is it that we are seeing so many Christians converting to Islam? And what is it that's driving that? So maybe you can respond to that. And then Mary Jo, as you follow up with what he's saying, there's a young university student. The question is, of the books mentioned tonight, which would you recommend to a young university student that cannot defend her faith? So which she should read first? So maybe just hit that. That'll segue us into wrapping up. So do you want to take the first one, Andy?
Sounds good. So what was the question?
So why do we see these Christians converting to Islam? Okay. What's motivating that?
Good question. So why do we see Christians converting to Islam? What's interesting, actually, is although because of sort of social media and other, you know, the internet and so forth, things can become, you know, very high profile, and we see perhaps more of this going on. When you actually look at studies that have been done, the numbers of people who convert to Islam is actually fairly low in terms of those converting from Christianity. Sadly, there are some people who make that transition, but numbers are fairly low. In fact, the largest numbers of people converting to Islam, when you look at the studies that have been done here in the West, there are two groups in particular who come up time and time and time again. Number one is women converting for marriage. That's by far the largest group of Westerners converting to Islam. So, you know, a woman perhaps meets a charming kind of Arab man at university, and perhaps he's what a manifest is fairly nominal, and they fall in love and, you know, get engaged. And at some point he says to her, you know, it would just make things much easier with my parents if you would just convert to Islam. And she thinks, oh, that's okay, and, you know, so on and so forth. And that number by far is the largest group of Westerners converting, women converting for marriage. Second group is interesting. Second group that's turned up in studies done both here in Canada and in America and back home for me in the UK, a group of Westerners converting to Islam, are black men converting within the prison system. Islam has done a remarkably good job using chaplains, particularly in the prison system, of advancing the narrative and the apologetic that goes this way. Islam is the religion of the black man. Christianity is the religion of the white man, and of course the white man has oppressed the black man, so you should become a Muslim. And that's the narrative that's being used. And there's a lot of work that I think as Christians we have to do countering that narrative. Slavery is often used as one of the, you know, chief examples of that. Look what was done in Africa during the years of the slave trade. Look what Christians did. Therefore, you should become a Muslim. And it's a very successful message when it's preached to sort of, you know, young men who are searching for identity, as many people are within the prison system. Interestingly, I've got a very good friend of mine who's an African theologian from Uganda. His name is John Azuma, and he did his PhD on this very issue. And one of his conclusions, he said, it's interesting. He said the history of the West African slave trade has been well told. That's the story of what Europeans did to Africa during those horrific years when slavery was at its height. It's horrific. That story's been told. But he said the story that hasn't been told is the story of the East African slave trade, which is what Arab slave traders did in the eastern side of Africa, because there was a huge slave trade running there as well. And he said, here's the thing that's shocking. If you ask yourself the question, where are the descendants of those who were enslaved from the West African slave trade? He said, well, you can look around North America today and see people who can trace their ancestry back to their ancestors being brought here as slaves, you know, hundreds of years before. Where are the equivalent descendants of those who were taken as slaves to the Middle East and to Muslim lands in the same time? Answer, they're nowhere to be found. Why, concludes John in his PhD thesis? Because, he said, brutal as the West African slave trade was, it was nothing compared to what was done in the East. But that story hasn't been told. And he says it needs to be, because that counteracts that narrative that's being used by many to try and win people to the Muslim faith. Now, what attracts people to Islam? I think a number of things. I think Islam's simplicity. Many people are looking for simple answers in a complex world. Islam offers very, very simple, stark answers. I think many people look at Christianity and conclude that we waffle on about things like, you know, gay marriage and other things and never actually talk about what we believe. Muslims talk about what they believe. They're not afraid of standing up for their beliefs in a way that Christians can sometimes be perceived to be. And also related to that, Muslims are sometimes the most confident evangelists you'll meet. While as Christians, like as Mary Jo was describing, you know, often sort of grow up thinking, well, it's rude to talk about my faith. I've never met a Muslim who thinks it's rude to talk about their faith. And I think that's a huge issue that we have to contend. We often keep our mouths shut, and Muslim friends often open them. That can be very attractive to many people. But at the same time, the story that's often not told, again, is what God is doing among Muslim people in terms of Muslims being won for Christ. It's easy to look at some of the statistics and think, gosh, it's, you know, it's terrible what's going on. But actually, when you look at what's happening, particularly in the Muslim world right now, there is an incredible work of God happening in many parts of the Muslim world. One of the results of what ISIS have done, with the brutality we've seen in places like Syria and other parts of the Middle East, is that's driven many Muslims away from Islam and into adopting Christianity. I've got a friend of mine who's an evangelist in Egypt who will tell you that his greatest problem right now is not Muslims becoming Christians, it's how to disciple them, because they have so many of the darn things. He said, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and our problem is what to do with them. In Iran, the church now is over a million and growing rapidly, despite the attempts of the authorities to oppress it and restrict it, and so on and so on and so on. I think we live in an age of unprecedented growth in the church among the Muslim world, partly helped by the fact we live in this interconnected digital world where Muslims can now read critiques of their faith, even if they live in closed countries. So I think we need to be praying for what God is doing among Muslims. We need to be looking for Muslims in our communities that we can outreach to. And if we meet people who are Muslims who tell you they were once Christians, as both Mary Jo and I have shared this evening, don't get reactionary, don't get hostile, don't feel threatened. Just say, well, tell me your story. What happened? What was the journey you went on? And use that to build a friendship and a dialogue, and then pray that the Lord would use you to show them a different kind of Christianity, not just through your answers, but through the way that you treat them.
So whoever tweeted this in, I want to thank you, because you're asking a nerd for a book recommendation. You're speaking my love language. All right, so you wanted one. Okay. So let me give you a couple here. It depends on your goal. So if you want to have conversation and you feel like maybe I'm not that good at conversation, then I would recommend myself my Why Do You Believe That study. So that would be good. Why Do You Believe That? You can get it, I believe, on Amazon as well as Lifeway.com. Another good book would be Tactics by Greg Kokel. Tactics is about how to share your faith as well, and it talks about asking questions in this pattern. So Why Do You Believe That would be good. Tactics is great. Then if you're interested in, like, I don't know arguments, like I don't know that you guys are talking all this stuff and I've not really encountered that. So I would recommend Andy Bannister's book, The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, because I found that book so amazingly intellectual and yet entertaining that I almost read it in one sitting. Because it was so good. And he goes through some of the common arguments that are made against Christianity today, and in a way that's just so much fun to read. So The Atheist Who Didn't Exist would be good for exposing you to the arguments you're going to face, and that is out there for sale. So one for conversation, one for arguments. If you want to learn those maybe basic logics, you can learn to hear when people are making mistakes. I would recommend The Fallacy Detective, that book. So if your goal is, I would like to become a better critical thinker overall, The Fallacy Detective is where I would start. If you've never been exposed to philosophy, critical thinking, or basic logic, that's a great non-intimidating place to start. So those are some suggestions. I would love to go on with more like Mere Christianity for C.S. Lewis if you're looking at, you know, how our Christian beliefs and the atheist arguments and culture all come together. I think Mere Christianity is a really great place to start. But those are my recommendations. And again, just thank you for being able to be here with you and to express some of these issues about how do we converse with people, because we are living in cultures that seem to become more polarized. Instead of becoming more tolerant, which is what the goal is, right? We keep hearing about tolerance as being the goal. It seems like we're dealing with less and less tolerance. And we're dealing with more intimidation for sharing what it is we believe and why. I hope tonight that we've encouraged you and that we've emboldened you and given you some ideas for directions that you can go to share the very good news of Jesus Christ, our Savior. Thank you.